Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 20th, 2002. And today's session is entitled Mountain Stories, the Coda Trail, Mountain Warfare. It is presented by Jonathan Ferrix, and it is number FRJ2002-07. Let's listen in.
You're in the right place if you're coming to a session that is called the Coda Trail, Mountain Warfare. My name is Jonathan Ferrix, and this series relates to the theme at Holden sort of because it's about wilderness. And this week I'm doing stories that talk about natural wildernesses, natural places on the planet that I've encountered in my avocation, which is hiking. Last week was about man-made wildernesses, places like Afghanistan and the Middle East that I go to as part of my vocation, which is communication work for the church in relief and development. So this is what I have to tell you here. Happened because I was on a job, but it has nothing to do with my job. And what I'd like to try to do with the time we have is tell you a real interesting story about World War II, which intersected pretty strongly with my own personal experience of this trail, the Kokoda Trail. So we need a little bit of World War II history, and it's pretty exciting stuff to think back. Before I say anything, is anybody here mature enough that they were actually a soldier in World War II? Okay, nobody. Increasingly now, you know, this is where we're at. Didn't used to be this way. But increasingly we're losing that living connection to World War II. But what we're talking about is the Pacific Theater. And let me just very, very briefly say, if this is China and Asia and Indonesia, well, that's not a good one. And this is Australia, where Norm and Jan come from, the people here in the village. All right? You've got Japan up here. You've got Australia here. You've got USA over here. And South America, etc. What Japan basically tried to do was to create this greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere as they began reaching out in the late 20s and into the early 30s. And if you remember, the first thing they did was they went over and messed with Korea at the beginning of the 1900s. Then they pushed into Manchuria early in the 1930s. Then they pushed into China throughout the middle of the 1930s. And they had pretty much taken over, I think, the top two-thirds of China by the time that Pearl Harbor happened here in the middle of the Pacific. And so once hostilities were declared, what Japan tried to do in very, very general terms, I think it's fair to say, is push this way to secure this flank towards India. And if you remember the campaign about Burma and the Burma airlift, and that was sort of their high water mark, that they made it a little bit into India, but hardly at all. And at the same time, they struck this way towards Pearl Harbor and later the Battle of Midway. But then they swept down through Southeast Asia. Remember taking Singapore, sinking a couple British battleships, pushing out through Indonesia. Native peoples in Indonesia and in Papua New Guinea, the place we're going to go for this session. Papua New Guinea looks sort of like this, like a dinosaur. Native peoples welcomed them because they threw off, and the Japanese played on this, threw off the white man colonial regimes. And didn't really have to fight that much until they got into the Malay Peninsula, took Singapore, pushed out through Indonesia, and started coming this way. What the strategy descriptions I've read said is they were thinking of pushing out here through the Solomon Islands and beyond. Even they had some thought of going as far as Fiji and Samoa. But if they could do that, they would then cut off the main natural sort of link between these two English-speaking places. And if they would have succeeded to push that way, and succeeded to push that way, they would have had their sort of greater East Asia co-prosperity sphere. And I don't think they really wanted to conquer Australia, or could have. But Australia didn't have very many people, a lot of space. And their plan was not to defend their continent north of the line drawn right through the middle. They were just going to cede the whole north to the Japanese if the Japanese would have invaded Australia. But this push resulted in a battle that most of us know. It starts with a G and it's got a lot of letters. Can you say name it?
Guadalcanal.
Guadalcanal. All right. And that's exactly the time I want to talk about. It's roughly August, September, October of 1942. So this was December of 41. And by August of 42, they were here. And if they could have taken Guadalcanal, the next stop would have been Fiji or maybe New Caledonia, and they might have succeeded in cutting off Australia as a place for the Allies to fight back and stage from, which is exactly what the Allies didn't in the end did. A little known campaign that was happening at the same time is the Kokoda campaign, our story today. Because here's the capital city of Papua New Guinea, Port Moresby. And the Japanese came down, as they came down in different places through these islands, they took the coast of Papua New Guinea and they came here to a place called Buna and Gona. And then they went from Buna and Gona inland to Kokoda, a plantation town, not plantation post really, not much of a place, under the Australian colonial administration. And remember this, at this time, Papua New Guinea is a perfect colonial island. This part is Dutch New Guinea, this half. The northern part had been German, but they lost in World War I, and the Allies gave it to Australia to administer under a League of Nations mandate. The southern part had been British, but they gave it to Australia to administer because Australia was their colony, and they sort of handed it over. So Australia administered these two and was holding this land against the Japanese advance and getting beaten initially. And so they came to Buna and Gona, the Australians were falling back. They came to Kokoda, the Australians were falling back. The town or the post of Kokoda changed hands two or three times in the initial assaults. And then they mounted a big push on Kokoda and under the name of command of a general called General Horii, and succeeded in taking it. And the story begins. And in broad sweeps, what happened was, from here to there, you have mountains that rise to 4,000 meters, so 14,000 feet, on different sides. But there is a trail that doesn't get much above 9,000 feet. And the Japanese thought they would push across this trail and push the Australians back and then come down on Port Moresby from the land at the same time as they were pushing around here by land. And I should just add one more thing I haven't said. I think May of 42, if I'm not mistaken, the Battle of the Coral Sea happened, in which they took a beating. It was a little bit inconclusive, but the Japanese fleet basically wasn't able to project their power beyond that battle in this area. So they failed by sea, they were trying to do it by land later in that same year. And this was a supporting action to the big thrust through Guadalcanal. And you take the capital of Port Moresby here, and then you'd have all of Australia sitting, probably to be neutralized, to the south of you. And so the story about the Kokoda Trail is they fought, the Japanese pushed the Australians back up this trail and down to this point here, which is the Imata Ridge, which is the last ridge before the sea, and from which you can look down 20 miles to the capital city of Port Moresby. And if they could have taken Imata Ridge, they would have had Port Moresby at their feet, the goal of their campaign. A little bit about the campaign. Is anybody confused about the general historical setting or want to add something? Okay. A little bit about the campaign. The Japanese were lightly armored, lightly equipped and rationed. and we're said to be living off the land, move with speed, get food from the natives, get food from the jungle, from gardens, and live that way, move fast. In their diaries of the fighting, they very clearly say that, whoa, these Australians are tough. These Australians are tougher than the Americans that we have been fighting. And I grew up in Papua New Guinea in Australia, and the Australians tell you very quickly when you're a little boy that they have the best soldiers in the world. And we always believed that they were the best soldiers, and the Japanese kind of bore that out. General Horii was told that he would have to establish a land line, a land approach to Port Moresby after he had won the campaign. They put in a road. And he wrote back, not certain that even horses can be used in this terrain. Because he had a habit of appearing before his troops on a white horse. And he was with that white horse all the way through the campaign. And at strategic moments, he would be seen on his white horse in front of his troops to inspire them. And if you could see the countryside we're going to see here, to have a horse there is really a strange notion of what of how to get around. Horses don't work very well in this terrain. A couple other things that I think are interesting for the military context. If this would be the way for them to attack Australia or neutralize Australia, Kokoda on the north side of the range would be the way to mount a counteroffensive and start pushing them back up the coast. So Kokoda started to loom large in the strategic training or thinking of the day. They figured, there's one Japanese officer's diary that exists, and their planning before the campaign started was to go in 2 days from Kokoda, and he just says to the mountains, and then 5 days from the mountains to Port Moresby. So he figured a 7-day campaign over this mountain range would do the trick. And it's essentially, it's a 40-hour walk. If you add up the trail times to Heart Lake and Lyman Lake and Cloudy Pass, and you say, how long is this walk going to be that we're going to take here on the Kokoda Trail? I've got a map I'll pass around. It's 40 hours of walking, which is about, what, 5 days of hiking? Depends how many hours you like to hike in a day. But he thought they were going to fight it and win it in 7 days. That didn't happen at all. It became, I think, about a 10-week campaign. Just a couple of other things here on the situation. What basically happened, the Australians tried to hold the trail, the Kokoda Trail itself, and the Japanese kept outflanking them and taking the high ground on each side and cutting them off. And so groups of Australians ended up trying to get home on their own through the jungle as they were cut off again and again by the Japanese advance. There was a ratio of 5 Japanese soldiers to every Australian who was defending Port Moresby and falling back in front of them. But the Australians, in their own assessment of their capacities, said and felt that 1 Australian was worth 3 Japanese. So there's 5 more times Japanese than Australians, but every Australian's worth 3 Japanese, so that evens the scales a little bit. But still, the Australians were pushed back and back and back. And this is August, late August it started, September and October of 1942. Now before I show you the pictures,
Johnson?
That I, yeah.
Wait, so were the Australians, where were they? They were camped out in Kokoda or what?
Yeah, it was an Australian colonial outpost.
Yeah.
And they held it, and the Japanese arrived. It changed hands a couple times. And then the Japanese push started. The command came from Rabaul, the Japanese regional command. Go for Port Moresby. And that's where they said it'll take you 5 days.
Well, how did they get reinforced?
Who?
The Australians.
They tried airdrops, but the airdrops actually had a better purpose than that. They served to give food to the New Guineans who were hiding in the bush. A lot of the airdrops went astray. They didn't get reinforced a lot. And so it was a tough campaign by the very fact that neither side could supply themselves. And if you see the terrain in a minute, you'll understand how that's true. I had a good talk with a missionary along the way in a village called Afogi. And he said that all the people of Afogi, and the New Guineans I talked to said the same thing, went into the bush and lived in caves throughout the war when the fighting was going on around there. And they watched their village get bombed. They came back to find a destroyed village and destroyed gardens. The Japanese, by traveling light, were using their food from the gardens to live on, so there was nothing left to eat. And they made do through the war, but after the war they were helped with some aid that Australia undertook in areas that it was controlling to help populations displaced by the war. And to this day, when you burn jungle in places like the Kokoda Trail, you can hear a little battle again, because ordnance that's 50 years old will still explode in a bushfire. So you can hear machine gun and mortars and bombs that haven't gone off as you clear the jungle for a garden or something like that. I'll just explain a little bit what the trail is like and a few things about our encounter with it. You can hike it in 4 days. It's about 40 hours of walking if you just add up the walking time and don't take any breaks. So you can hike it in 4 10-hour days, theoretically, and there are people who do that. One New Guinean ran it in 33 hours. And there'll probably be a Kokoda Marathon someday, Ultra Marathon, in which you could be an entrant. But this is roughly, very roughly, the sort of side view of what you're doing, and if you add up all the ups, you get about twice the climbing of Everest in the time you're looking at there, with the number of feet you go over. We crossed here a place where there was a bridge out, a footbridge out, and when we first started, we met two Australian hikers just coming off the trail who'd been out and in their third day came to this river they couldn't cross and gave up and came back. And so our first taste of the Kokoda Trail was, gee, you're gonna come to a river in 3 days that you can't cross. What do you do when you get that kind of trail advice? You give up and go home? Or you go and you hope you can get across. Well, we went and we hoped we could get across. And you'll see a picture of a huge tree that we found by going upstream that had fallen and seemed like 45 degrees, I'm sure it wasn't. And we walked down this huge tree and across the river that way and managed to keep going at that point. That was somewhere here. Another interesting thing I'll talk about was this series here where you have 9 false summits. You know what a false summit is? Buckskin has 3 false summits. What we're seeing is actually the third highest peak. You get there and you see another one, and you get there and you see another one. Well, this is a series of ridges, and you think you've come to the top of the ridge 9 times. And that's, you know, something for hikers to think about, but imagine if you're a soldier and you're carrying heavy munitions and weapons and all those things that they make for the army, which aren't light, but you have to move around. There's an area in here where we came across moss that glowed in the night and bugs that whistled so loud that you thought your hearing was going to be impaired and tried to outdo each other in the forest canopy, spreading this whistle around. We came to the place where the white horse of General Horii was found by the Australians when they finally pushed the Japanese back. They found his horse in a carcass of his horse in a creek where he had finally given up trying to get a horse around in that country and had to leave it there as he withdrew himself from the advancing Australians. And I think what I'll do is show you the slides I've got and then continue the story after that. Can we have someone turn off the light, please? Lights. I think the far right switch does everything. Yeah. And if you could just push the projector switch forward on the top, that your side, yeah. Push the top one all the way forward. All right. And please interrupt if something isn't clear or... This is the reason I was in that part of the world. It's near a town called Papandeta, near Kokoda, where I was conducting a pastor's radio workshop. That's an ecumenical group of pastors and church workers spanning everybody except the Roman Catholics. And we had free time on provincial radio, and part of my job was to train them in how to use the radio for the church's work.
They speak pidgin English.
Yeah, we used pidgin, we used English. This is in the Papuan side, so pidgin, if you know Papua New Guinea at all, isn't quite as important there. But it was an Anglican training center, Anglican meaning, it's Episcopal here. And so, when the work was done, I believe it was Holy Week, maybe Monday of Holy Week when we started out, and there's a person up in the balcony who had given me permission not to come home for Easter that year. Or actually, I thought that I might be home for Easter, because it was a four-day hike, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, be home on Good Friday.
And likely story.
Yeah. So, the person that matters for the story is here, Scott Charlesworth, a YMCA worker in Leh, Papua New Guinea, where the town where we lived. And that's a younger version of myself. I have this backpack here, if anybody would like to see the backpack. This is the Kokoda Trail National Walking Track. And these are Japanese Anglicans. And so we had a double bond with them, because they were coming to be with the Anglicans of New Guinea, but they were also coming as Japanese to see this place where their army had suffered much, and where World War II had unfolded in this special campaign. So we took a picture, we had a nice visit with them, and then we set out at about 3:30 in the afternoon. There's the part of the memorial, and Australians know this as this kind of a picture here. There's one of the Japanese Anglicans examining it as the Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels. What you've got is an Australian soldier on a stretcher being carried by two Papua New Guineans. And Papua New Guineans are Melanesians. They have frizzy hair. And I don't know if it's racist, but they were called Fuzzy Wuzzy Angels because of the way they saved so many lives. The Japanese were moving too fast to even pick up their own wounded from the battlefield. The Australians tried to take all their wounded back with them. There you see a close-up of that. You could say the black people doing this kind of work in the white man's and Asian man's war. And one Australian was awarded the Victoria Cross. He, Bruce Steele Kingsley, VC, that's Victoria Cross. It's the Congressional Medal of Honor, the highest award in the British Empire for bravery. At Isuraba, a place we'll see just in a minute. So we set out through a rubber plantation through which the Australians had to retreat as the Japanese took Kokoda. And it was a misty night, and the Japanese were somewhere out there in those trees, and the Aussies were drawing back, and the battle for the Kokoda Trail began here on the outskirts of Kokoda, and it's still a rubber plantation. Came to the Kumusi River, the river that flows from the creek where the carcass of the Japanese general's horse was found. And a reminder of what you're going to see, because this river is coming from somewhere. It's coming from the mountains where you're going to go. And there's no shortage of water in Papua New Guinea ever. Especially when you're hiking, you notice it. First night at a lean-to, this is what passes for a mountain hut on the Kokoda Trail. There's Scott. And after 3 or 4 hours, dusk falls at 6 p.m. in the tropics all year round. You know, the sun is up from 6 to 6. We're right near the equator. So you can't hike until 9 o'clock at night unless you have a flashlight. Gaining a little altitude the next day and looking back towards Kokoda. And I have to say, yesterday we showed Kilimanjaro and Mount Kenya. beautiful light, beautiful vistas. None of that today. But the gloomy, the dark greens, the clouds are exactly what you see there and make this kind of jungle hiking rather different from hiking above the tree line. This tree line in the tropics here is probably at 10,000 feet, so you don't get there very fast. A place where they had cleared the jungle a little bit for a cattle project, see the zebu breed? Something different, something unusual for this spot, introducing cattle. A typical bridge on the trail. Now the trail is maintained by local people who use it to go from village to village, and then hikers come periodically. I haven't been there. This story comes from 1979, so I'm not sure of the condition of the trail today. After one long up on that second day, we were resting at the top, and along comes a man carrying a World War II stretcher over his shoulder, a canvas stretcher, a canvas bed that you can make out and sleep on, and he's got it over his shoulder wrapped up, and he's got this backpack, and then if you look closely, he's walking on the tops of his feet. His feet are inverted and turned inward. And we had just labored up this climb. It drops way down there to the valley. We had just labored up it, and we're feeling like we needed a well-deserved rest and thought we'd been pretty tough. And this guy comes along, and we had a brief conversation with him, and he takes off down the trail at about three times the speed that we had been going, walking on the tops of his feet with his feet turned in, and carrying a World War II stretcher.
Why would that be that he would walk on the top of his
feet? He was deformed, and he had just learned to do that. Therapy or crutches, he didn't need crutches. It's just an amazing adaptation to a crippling condition of some kind. Again, you get a place where the trees break, and you take a shot of the landscape. Isurava was a big battlefield during the campaign, and there was one house left there. Typical house for that part of Papua New Guinea. These are woven bamboo walls, and this is a grass roof that you replace every couple years with long, strong grasses. The Japanese came, picture this, the Japanese came from here across the valley and took Isurava. Where are you going to meet them? How are you going to meet them? Where are they coming from? These are the conditions they were fighting in. Another view of the trail. Some women getting water from a creek that crosses the trail. You cross a water course every 10 or 15 minutes hiking in a place like Papua New Guinea. And it's best just to wear canvas boots and just walk through everything with them on, something that dries quickly. Another place where a battle had been fought, and by this time, this is into the end of the second day, I was getting a bit frustrated because we weren't seeing any relic. We weren't seeing any, machine guns or anything like that. Any busted cars. Partly there was no motorized use of equipment on that campaign, and partly the jungle covers everything. But there's a boy, or a man, with a Bren gun. And he wanted to sell it to us. He'd found it, and he knew that some hikers would buy these things. And all you had to do was pick it up once, and you very quickly could decide you weren't going to buy that Bren gun. Because it was, I don't know what it weighed, but you just didn't want it in your backpack. So he showed it to us, and we said, thank you very much. This is the village of Alola, and that's the guest house that we stayed in Alola the second night. Alola village. The Seventh-day Adventist Church has come through here and pretty much wiped out all the earlier mission work and taken the area over and made them all Seventh-day Adventists. And this is a tithe house. You bring a tithe of your harvest, and you put it there, and then when the pastor comes, he takes it. And that's the way you give to the church in a place where you don't have a cash economy. two of the angels of that village came to us with some fresh vegetables, and we agreed on a price and had some fresh vegetables for supper that night. Notice the weather, notice the climate. It's warm, but very cloudy. Another view of Alola village, and across the way another village called Abuari, both of which were heavily fought for.
Typical construction there?
Yeah. Yeah. Efogi Creek, one of the many creeks you got to cross, usually without bridges. And then, this is that tree I was talking about. It was long and huge and went way, way up, and I just aimed the camera down the tree, and then there's Scott going across a part of the bridge that hadn't been wiped out, or had been added recently for this crossing. And we found this by working our way up the stream, up this river to get across. Just a rock with some interesting lines. Since there aren't many panoramas, you start to take pictures of little things. So there's some mushrooms. Anybody like know if mushrooms are edible or fungus? I'm not sure. If you look closely, there's a hole here. And guess what it is? It's a foxhole, part of the campaign. And that's about as satisfying as the war relics got on this trail. Everything was covered over. You could jump in there and be up to your neck in this old foxhole. There were lots of foxholes in various defensive positions left by the Australians. But you couldn't get a clean shot of them, and they weren't very obviously what you hoped they would be. And there's also one behind this. There's Scott taking a little break. Another river crossing. A place, this is called Templeton's Crossing. If you ever read a story about the Kokoda Trail, Templeton's is a big deal. And somebody had made a makeshift shelter there on one of the other trekking parties coming through, I guess. And night began to fall on this, the third day, and we had a long climb ahead of us over something called Mount Bellamy. And we started to get in something that's called cloud forest. It's forest that's often in the clouds, so the trees get burdened with lots and lots of moss, and everything is pretty wet. And dark fell, and we hadn't come to the lean-to we were trying to get to. So we kept pushing on, but first bad mark, I'm going to give you several strikes against myself here in the coming minutes. First one was, neither of us had a flashlight. You know, you strip weight down, you think, why carry flashlight and batteries? You just figure, we'll stop by the time it's dark. Well, we didn't want to stop because there was really no place to stop. There was a lean-to on the description. So we pressed on. And it got dark, and so we started basically walking by feel, you know, like blind people, because there was no moon, and you're in the jungle. And that's when we noticed this moss, which glows. It was like you took milk, made it radioactive, and then poured it out of the ground. And there was glowing moss. So, you know, maybe it was a light from God helping us find a way, I'm not sure. But, and then these little insects, no idea what they were, but they would start screaming. And one would scream, and then the next one would scream, and the next one would scream, and the next one would scream, and it would start way behind you on down the mountain. And this sound would sweep up through the canopy of the forest. And as each one picked it up, it was like a wave of sound going over your head at a very high frequency and disappear way up the mountain in front of you. And all of this in the dark with glowing moss. So we finally found this lean-to, and here it is the next morning. We found the lean-to probably 9 o'clock at night, and we had a pretty good night there. And we're ready for the fourth day. I took this picture because I guess I was just thinking about how I didn't ever fall off bridges, and I stepped on this bridge and fell promptly into the creek below. So it's sort of like pride comes before a fall. got to a pretty high place on the trail, and we started to see the settlement, the village of Kagi. And that's a very typical view for much of Papua New Guinea. Jungle-covered mountains, a village on a ridge, and then here is this, an airstrip.
That's right.
Anybody a pilot?
You take off into the void.
Yeah, you take off downhill, and you always have a drop at the end in case you're heavily loaded, so you can drop a bit before you fly away. And we, when I was a kid, we used to stand here on our airstrip, and sometimes the planes would be so heavily loaded they would disappear for a while into the valley before they'd climb on out, you know, 5-10 miles away. And Kagi has that kind of airstrip. Look at the little dip at the bottom, just to keep you alert. Here's Kagi again. One house with tin. And here's an SDA, a Seventh-day Adventist church worker who was probably 20 years old. And when this man was that age, he was a carrier. He was a Fuzzy Wuzzy Angel in World War II. And we listened to him and heard about his story. And he stood at attention there for the picture in Kagi. When you go through a village, you often come to a sty like this. It's to keep the pigs on one side, and you have to clamber over. There's Scott hopping over the pigsty. The trail again. Another river crossing. River to cross. This is the place where the Japanese general's horse was found, at this crossing. So imagine a white horse lying in this strange place.
How long would a horse like that last if I find it without being...
Alive or dead?
Dead.
You mean the carcass?
Isn't there carrion? Yeah.
Oh, it would just go.
Oh, okay.
It would just decay. But the Aussies found Horie's horse in that creek right there when they came back as they pushed the Japanese back.
Okay, so it was the same time frame.
Yeah. You see the drop-off and the climb on the other side, that's just really typical. Another town, Manari.
This was 79, did you say?
79, yeah. This man was also a carrier, and when I asked to take his picture, he again stood up very straight and posed. Little clearing in the jungle. Some village women crossing a bigger river. But wait a minute. What's this here? See this green bar? Kids who follow you when you leave a village have a lot of fun. Chasing after you for a while and talking and playing. Scott, sort of looks like Adam and Eve, or Adam. And there's some brown stuff on the side of the film here.
Age.
The pack I have here today still, and now there's a green stripe. And this green and brown, see the discoloration? Oh wow, look at that.
It's the moss.
Moisture gets out of your film, doesn't it?
Guess what happened, you guys?
Moisture.
Before I tell you, let me show you one more picture.
Sky.
Meanwhile, Marion had lost all faith in me. Holy Week was dragging on. And she decided she'd go out to the highlands of Papua New Guinea and have a cultural encounter with the New Guineans. So here's Marion, who's upstairs right there now, at a show in the town of Goroka on another trip we took at that time. But Papua New Guineans celebrating with their distinctive dancing dress. Could we turn the lights on again, please? Excuse me?
those discolored film?
Well, that's what I have to explain to you now, and here's where the Fifth Amendment starts to become important. What happened was, we got to this place called Manari shortly after where General Horiti's horse was. And it says on the map that I'll pass around here now, it says 3 hours from Manari to the next village, Naro. And this was on the, about late morning of the fourth day. It's probably a little dark up here if you want to take a look at that. It said 3 hours on that map between Manari and Naro. And the biggest path went right, and a littler path went left. And so we took the right path. It was bigger. Mind you, we're working with a map, a topo map, shot by the U.S. Air Force in 1943. And wherever there were clouds on that June day when they filmed it, the map just said, obscured by clouds. All right. And then we had this thing, which is sort of a scheme of the whole trail, but not very valuable for hiking. So you're relying on yourself, but mostly on what you can ask of New Guineans, and a little bit of sketching on that trail there, on the trail map there. Well, we took the bigger path and went up a steep, steep hill, and within minutes I thought to myself, I wonder if this is right. We went 45 minutes and came to a garden. And then I really thought, this is a garden path, this isn't the Kokoda Trail. But I immediately sort of started to slide into Plan A. And Plan A was basically never retreat. Instinctively, I didn't call it that at the time, but you know, 45 minutes in a hot tropical day, climbing a steep slope, do you want to go back?
No.
Or you want to see if you can go forward and make good on what you may have done wrong? We decided to go forward. We went through the gardens, they're very steep, and at the other side couldn't really find a good path to continue on, but we found a little one, so we continued on the little one. It became very clear that this was not the Kokoda Trail quite quickly. Did we go back? No. We got out the map, we got out both maps, we looked at the trail, we looked at this mountain we were on, so we've done this now, instead of this. I think we're supposed to go to the left side. We're ending on the right side on this steep garden. And we thought, well, we'll go over the mountain, down the other side, and pick up the trail on the other side. Couldn't do that. It was too steep. Tried. We were hauling ourselves up through spiky things and various kinds of insects and just stuff that said to you, why are you doing this? So we decided to hang a right. You could still have gone back. We're only about an hour, hour and a half into this misadventure at this point. Could still have gone back. You know, today I wouldn't even think of that day if I had gone back an hour and a half. And it was downhill, so it was probably less than that. But we decided, well, Plan A isn't going to work, can't retreat, but we'll do Plan B. And Plan B is sort of a tactical adjustment. We thought we'd go right and then drop down this mountain and then go left at the bottom and pick up the trail on the other side of the mountain. Logical?
No.
Come on. It seemed like it to us. And as we were doing this, across and then down, the down was very steep, and amazingly enough, we found probably a mile of foxholes and trenches down the steep slope of that mountain, way off the Kokoda Trail, something nobody would see. Equally grown in by jungle and everything. Not that exciting just to look at, but when you thought of people fighting in that place, you just sort of said, man alive, what were these guys up to? Well, we got down to the bottom, and we came to a very fast-flowing river, the Naro River. And we thought, this side was very steep. There were no trails that we had seen. We thought, after thinking for a while, and our brains were not serving us very well anymore, we sort of came up with the idea that we'd have to go across the river and pick up the trail on the other side. So we made a raft, out of some logs, bound them together with vines, put the backpacks on the raft, and swam and walked across the river. Had difficulty getting out on the other side, but the backpacks were still dry, and we were wet, but that didn't matter. You're only wearing a little bit of clothes, and it's hot, you dry off quickly. Climbed out on the other side, and promptly got into, you could say, a situation of superior force against us. What was on the other side was quicksand and a palm that, you know, God must have been sleeping when evolution or whoever made this palm, because we began to call it the devil palm, I think. Was a huge crown of palm fronds coming from a short stump. And on the back of the whole main branch part, there were barbs going backwards. So if you brushed against it, it would had a good way of grabbing you. And then, worse than that, there were huge antennas that went out much farther than the leaves and were thin and came dangling down, and they had barbs on them too. And so, very quickly, after reaching the other side of the river, Scott and I are up to here in quicksand, and you can go. You can keep going if you lean forward and sort of swim. So that's what we did. But it's pretty hard to swim when these, you know, razor wire things are kind of holding you back. They're grabbing your backpack, they're grabbing your shirt, they're grabbing your skin, they're grabbing your head. And so we
these gave up.
Well, I don't know if they gave up. They're probably too smart to go there. But we gave up. So this advance, you know, down and across and pick up the trail, just really failed badly. We had to retreat. There was just no way. It's like we had met a superior force, and there was no way we were going to prevail against it. So that was plan B, the tactical recovery. Tactical adjustment didn't work. So then we came up with plan C, and by this time it's probably 4 o'clock in the afternoon. And I think we got lost at about 10 a.m. We've had a hard day going down that steep mountain, fighting the river, building the raft, fighting the river, dealing with the sand and these cuckoo palms. We retreat to the river, and we came up with plan C, and I think of it today and I think, you know, what were we doing? But plan C was a harebrained alternative. And it, you know, plan A resulted in making our predicament worse by not retreating. Okay, plan B ended in sheer and utter defeat. And plan C ended in a near-death experience. What happened was we looked at our map again, and in 1943, the U.S. Air Force had identified Motilogo Village down the Nora River from where we were. And so somehow, finding the trail had vanished from our minds at this point, and we didn't think of alternatives, of which there were some. And we decided we'd get in the river and we'd use the river. And we'd go down the river to Motilogo Village. We had the raft, it had worked on the first crossing. We would be in the water, the backpacks would be on the raft, and off we'd go. And I have to say, it's not completely harebrained because I like swimming, I like rivers. I've been in a lot of rivers and some with some real strong rapids. And Scott, you know, led me to believe that he was also happy about rivers. But we just felt defeated on land, and we thought water would be nicer to us. Well, we got into the river, and very quickly, the raft ran into some submerged wood, some trees, and started getting snagged. And we'd have to get it loose, and then it started getting water, and the backpack started getting wet, and the raft was just a disaster. So we gave up on the raft. We pulled the backpacks off and just held onto the backpacks and swam and walked with the backpacks floating. Well, they floated for a while, but then they started water in them, and they began floating underwater. They never really sank. But we were all wet and our clothes, pardon?
Yes, they did.
Well, we're not there yet. And what my superior river craft allowed me to get out of the water and not get sucked into the fastest parts of the river. Because the fast parts were too deep to stand. It was brown water and fast flowing tropical river. But you could go kind of cutting the corners and stay out of the worst stuff. And so I was saying to myself, yeah, you can do this, you can do this. But I couldn't make Scott do it. And he was not as used to the river or something. And so he was getting swept out into the deeper currents and going much faster than he should have and in danger of whatever the river could do to him. And I was getting aware of that, and he was also getting farther and farther behind. And then at one point where I was also swimming, there were a lot of snags underwater hitting me in the shins and things like that and hitting Scott. And then at one point, without any sign on the surface, a tree about that big must have been right across the river. And it caught me right in the guts. And I had my backpack already in front of me, hanging on by one arm. And I had to do a complete flip and be winded at the same time to hang on to my pack. But I managed that, and I shouted back to Scott. And he avoided the worst of it there. But then very shortly thereafter, another big tree was underwater with branches sticking up. And a big strong branch went right through the shoulder strap of his backpack. And so he swung around, and he's like being towed behind a boat, because he's hanging onto his pack, which was stuck to the tree, which was immovable in the river. Mm-hmm. And the current just pushed him underwater as he hung onto his backpack. So he had to choose between his life and our food, because he had all of our food. And he chose the right choice, and he let go of the backpack. Well, we never saw it again, because it was stuck under this submerged tree. And Scott got swept away and then came up for air. And I was watching this happen, and I thought, you know, he's going to drown. And I was too far away to help him. And I saw a sandbar within a couple hundred yards of where we were, and managed to crawl out on it and wave to Scott, and he managed to get over towards it, and he climbed out on the sandbar. Well, we probably went, I don't know, 5 miles in the river, and we never found the village. Did it exist? Probably in 1943, but was it still there? The villages move, you know, when they get done with the gardens, they move. So the whole scheme was really pretty wacky at that point. And that sense of physical beating from the plants, from the sand, from the water, and, you know, the threat of drowning, and just the sense of stuff going against you really had a pretty strong effect on me. And worst of all, yeah, you're lost, and what you've tried hasn't worked. And Scott made it very clear that his life was in my hands. And I thought, yeah, that's not fair. We gotta be in this together. But I knew more about bushwalking, supposedly, than he. And so he just really said, you know, it's up to you, buddy. And that was really scary, because, you know, you can do things that you think you might be able to get through, but to have somebody else relying on you and to know how little you knew and how poorly you had behaved so far was not a good feeling at all. We spent the night huddled together, just like, you know, peas in a pod, trying to keep each other warm, wrapped up in a ground sheet because everything was wet. And it was strangely cold for a tropical place that night. But God gives us the day and the night, and everything always looks different the next morning. And so something I learned harder that time than ever before, and has been important since, is if you're in trouble, you know, go to bed, have a rest, look at things again in the morning. And sure enough, in the morning, it was better weather. The rains, which we had faced all the time until then, had stopped. An airplane went over, and we waved to it from the sandbar and said, "Help, rescue us." You know, it was way up high. Well, of course it wasn't looking for us, but we felt like we would pretend it was, and maybe they would pay attention. There was a little bit of food left. I think I had some gorp in my pack, and I had a stove, and it was now nicely soaked in brown river water, but we cooked it and ate it, and that was our last meal. And then we took stock of our situation, and what we did, so we spent that episode going down to about here. We got off the sandbar on this side of the river. We made that little foray into the quicksand and the palms. And we decided the best thing to do was to go back on this side of the river and just go upriver, no matter what it took out of us, stick to that river because we knew the Kokoda Trail crossed that river up here. And we would do our darndest to get back to the Kokoda Trail that way. And what happened then that morning, from 6 a.m. we got rolling until 3 in the afternoon. We picked our way up that bank. And we did what we didn't do the day before, is when you're on a trail, you're fine. When you think you're off the trail, go back to the last place where you knew you were on the trail and start again. And sure enough, we missed a little fork here, and we missed a little fork there. And after, I don't know, 3 or 4 hours, we came to a clearing with some gardens and one house, and there were some bananas. So we ate bananas. We stole them shamelessly and ate the bananas. And then we kept walking. And by about 3 in the afternoon, we came to the Kokoda Trail. And it was clear as daylight at this point. And we'd gotten so good at following these little tiny garden trails and individual family trails. So we step out onto the trail, and right there, as we stepped out, and imagine, you saw the picture of us at the beginning. Now we're shredded and dirty and hungry and cold. And we didn't know that, maybe, but we stepped out onto the trail, and along came, right at that moment, right near us, we're approaching two Papua New Guinean women. And a New Guinean woman and a white man don't encounter themselves very well. There's several issues that come instantly to mind in an isolated place like that. Let alone when the two men looked like we looked and we said, "Hey, where are we?" These women were carrying big pieces of a cow that had been butchered. Like one had the hind leg and one had the rib cage. They dropped the cow and bolted up the trail without any show of concern for our predicament. So we went that way because that was the way we needed to go to get to that village. And we soon met them hiding behind their mom and their dad, carrying the rest of the cow. And we talked to their mom and dad, and we found out that yes, we were in fact between Manari and Naro village, which was right here. And so we reached Naro village. And I said that it was 3 hours from here to there, if you stayed on the trail. Well, when we reached the trail again right there, it was 30 hours. So a factor of 10 in this misadventure took care of us, of our attempt to do the Kokoda Trail successfully. And I'll just finish by saying that we rested. People gave us some food here. We had nothing to carry anymore in the way of food. We carried a bit the first day, after that the next day as we went. We got lost again the next day, but this time we went back. It only cost us 3 hours. We met some other hikers, and they gave us a granola bar, which was our only food on that day. We had a night without any food the last night on the trail. And then we came to these two places here. That's Yoribaiwa Ridge, where the Japanese made it in late September of 1942. And facing them across one of those deep divides, like I showed you on the slides, is Imata Ridge, where the Australians set up their last defensive position. And they were ready to defend Imata, but they only had 300 men left. And the Japanese had more men, and they were on Yoribaiwa, right across the void between the two ridges. But the attack never came. And the Aussies waited 10 days, and then sent out reconnaissance patrols, and on the morning of the 10th day, crept up to a Yoribaiwa Ridge, and they found the Japanese rice still warm in the cooking pots, the coals in the fire still warm, the camp deserted, freshly deserted that morning by the Japanese. And what had happened was, Guadalcanal, the Japanese high command had determined, was lost. They would not win. They were admitting to themselves they would not prevail in the Solomon Islands. And so the campaign against to get Port Moresby was pointless if they couldn't get the major thrust successfully done. So they sent word to Hori'i, withdraw. And the Aussies then, when they found out the Japanese had left that morning, ran down this area here and started chasing them back and fought them all the way back through the things I described in the Nine Fall Summits and the other villages of Kagi and Afobi and Isaraba, all the way back to Kokoda. And near, at the sea beyond Kokoda, are these two places, Buna and Gona. And when they got to Bunangona, the Japanese built bunkers out of coconut trunks from a coconut plantation. Bunkers that they could fight from. And as the Australians attacked, the Japanese stayed in their bunkers and fought to the last man. The soldiers were standing on the bodies of their comrades that were already dead and fighting and fighting and fighting. And General MacArthur, Douglas MacArthur, is sitting here in Brisbane, Australia, watching the campaign as the supreme, I think, American commander, at least for land operations. And he wrote that if the Japanese fought like that for Buna and Gona, how would they fight for Singapore? How would they fight for Taiwan? How would they fight for Japan? And he developed the strategy of island hopping. So he said, we're not even going to bother to fight them. We're going to go around them. And he did that all the way through the Pacific campaign there for the next 3 years until the war was over. Island hopping from here, leaving Rabaul, where 50,000 Japanese were still in place at the end of the war, never having been defeated, because he just cut them off. He went around the back and left them there. He jumped up to here, he jumped up to here, 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 and you know the campaigns, Okinawa and Iwo Jima, and he went on some of the battles in the atolls of the Pacific Ocean. So that strategy of island hopping was developed on the heels of the Kokoda Trail campaign because of the way they fought for this coconut plantation on the coastal lowlands on the other side of this range. Now just a few comments about the link between what happened to us and what happened to the Japanese. We had maybe a 2% taste, I think, of what it would have been like to fight there. We had deprivation and hunger and things that were not easy to deal with. Exposure, exhaustion, physical injury, in a minor way. But think of a soldier carrying a 45-pound pack plus his ammunition and his heavy gun. Think of the Japanese moving and living off the land. We tried to live off the land, and you know, it was two bananas, and that was about it. Think of the Australians who were so harassed by this advance that some of them kept their boots on for a week in those conditions. And that really got me, because of what happened to us, we kept our boots on for, I think, 2.5 days. And when we took them off, some of the skin went with it. When the Australian soldiers took them off, the flesh left the bones on their feet, because it had become steamed in the heat and the damp. You're always wet. The sense of relying on yourself, the sense of uncertainty, gave us a little tiny taste of the struggle that had gone on. And these were not, at the beginning at least, they were not seasoned Australian troops. Some came later from the campaigns in North Africa and joined them and did some of the hard fighting with more seasoned troops. But the early troops facing these Japanese were just fresh recruits, Australian farm boys. You've seen some of the Australian war movies. Like Gallipoli, that was the situation we're in. And I just want to leave you with the thought that if you're hiking and you get lost, the best thing to do is to go back to the last place you know you weren't lost. Now, when this happened to me, I was 29 years old. You'd think I would have known that by then, but I didn't. I mean, I knew it, but I didn't act on it. That's really the main thing to say, because that gets you out of all the rest of the trouble. But if you get into trouble, I'd say think long and hard before you dream up some of these schemes to get yourself out, because every scheme I dreamed up as the leader of this two-man expedition just made it worse.
Because how late were you getting back from what you thought you would be?
Yeah. The plan was to be home for Easter, a 4-day hike. We got out on the 7th day. So we were 2.5 days overdue. And Marion can say what she thought. She thought during those 2.5 days. But there was a little bit of slop in the system. in terms of when she didn't expect me home right on the fourth day. So
this reminds me of an uncle who was in there, and they got cut off frequently,
mm-hmm.
and they had no food. And he once wrote and said he that they had to eat their pet lizards and all kinds of things.
Eat lizards?
Yeah.
Maybe that's what we should have done.
You just weren't that desperate.
Yeah. No, it's a short time, you know, we're lost for 30 hours once and 3 hours the second time. But the intensity, I honestly felt, if Scott's relying on me, he's got a problem. Because I knew I had a problem. You know, but I couldn't say that because, you know, morale is important and there's nobody else to do anything about it. So I think there's some real parallels with people who fight it. If there's any link to what the world we're facing now is, you know, real hard for war to make any sense. Real hard to square what happens to war, to soldiers, let alone to civilians, who are now by far the biggest victims of war. 9 civilians die for every soldier with modern warfare. Real hard to make any sense out of that when you look at this campaign. At one of the Japanese diaries, the guy wrote about his friend, and he said how happy they were, and what a fine guy this was, and what a great day they were having. And that afternoon they had a skirmish, and his friend was killed. And he's writing in the jungle on his trail, and he's saying, you know, what a tragedy it is for such a young life to end in such a ridiculous place, from the Japanese point of view. So you get little slivers of what the people are going through who are not out there by choice.
One quick question. I know this is another story, but I'm still interested. You grew up in Papua New Guinea? Where?
Yeah. I was born in Leh and lived in different places around there. And when this campaign was happening, my dad was actually still in the interior of Papua New Guinea as a missionary. He was only evacuated in 43. And because he had a German surname, and because a lot of the Germans had already been, the German Lutheran missionaries had already been taken off to internment camps in South Australia. Because a couple of them had, you know, Nazi sympathies. They were Germans, and Nazi was the Hitler government was their government, and it brought Germany back from the Depression. And there was a Nazi flag found in one of the mission stations. So the Australian colonial authorities, when war broke out, rounded up all the Germans and put them in camps in Australia for 5 years. My dad was an American with a German name, so they detained him when they finally brought him out. And he was followed for about a year, he said, back here in the States. Mm-hmm. Now and then there would be indications that somebody was checking up on him. But he and the two Catholic priests and another Lutheran were evacuated in May of 43 from a place here by a DC-3. They landed on a jungle strip, and they were told to be there by the Australian district officer. The Japanese didn't really go into the interior that much. They just held the coast. You know the way they paint names on warplanes? This was two priests and two pastors getting evacuated, and the plane was called Hell's Angel. So,
were you in the United States? When were you born?
I was born after the war in Papua New Guinea.
Oh, so they went back?
Yeah. He was gone for 2 years. I went back in 45. And Papua New Guinea is covered in war relics. I mean, much more satisfying than Kokoda Trail. As kids, we played on B-17s and P-38s and PT boats, and we collected machine gun bullets, got the gunpowder out of them, and made it go up, made it blow up. Found piles of grenades in the jungle.
I wouldn't say that too often.
Yeah, there's no kids here.
I'm here.
Yeah. So thanks a lot. Anybody under 30, that idea that it's better to go back.